Most Wanted podcasts on BBC Sounds. Where is the missing crypto queen's billionaire scammer?
It starts to get very scary, very, very fast.
How did gangster's drug baron finally get caught?
He was taken completely unawares.
Why were Burn Wild's environmentalists labelled eco-terrorists?
For a long time, they were getting away with it, but that wouldn't last.
Uncover a new case
while the dog drags you out for a walk.
Listen to True Crime Podcasts on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
The FIA headquarters are housed in a vast and impressive columned edifice on the Place de la Concorde in Paris. There's a constant barrage of traffic skirting its entrance. During the French Revolution, the Grand Square was the site of the most high-profile public executions. We're talking Marie Antoinette, Robespierre, and Louis XVI. But on the 26th of July, 2007, it's McLaren's turn to face the guillotine. All 27 members of the FIA's World Council, among them the most powerful men in the business, are here to decide if their code on fairness and conduct has been violated. Think of them like the UN of motorsport. This is McLaren's opportunity to defend themselves. Ferrari won't get to speak, but they've dropped a bombshell ahead of the hearing. The Italian team is alleging that the data went way beyond one rogue employee and right to the top of the British team. Strap in, because Spygate is going on trial, F1 style.
I still can't believe it happened. The extent of it, the way it was done.
It was like a bomb that exploded within the team.
I've never heard of anything like that at that level. That's crazy.
Would you do anything to win? You probably would.
Everyone's so arrogant. They thought they were untouchable.
This has turned into an all-out brawl, and it's happening in front of the entire world.
Formula One really looked into the abyss in 2007.
One of the biggest stories in the history of Formula One.
But it will haunt the people involved for as long as they live.
I'm Pete Tong, and this is Sport's Strangest Crimes, Spygate. Chapter 4, The Iron Fist in the Velvet Glove.
Walking through the crowd to get into the offices was quite dramatic. It's usual to have the motorsport press there. This was something entirely different. I mean, the international press were there, including television. It was just quite an event, I have to say.
This is Graham Stoker, a lifelong racing fanatic who worked his way all the way up to the top while also being a serious legal eagle. Graham started off racing for fun and then got seriously involved in the governance of motorsport. Back in 2007, as Britain's representative on the Motorsport World Council, he's just landed in Paris. He's a barrister, so in his words, he's not flustered by the occasion. But he does feel something of the rock star vibes, making his way through a sea of flashing paparazzi to a red cordon which is opened for him by security. He goes straight up to the Salle de Comité, right up on the fifth floor.
Good idea to take the lift, because if you walk up the stairs, you arrive at the top, seriously out of breath. It's in a room with a very, very large oval table. People sit round it, the 27 members sit round it. There's simultaneous translation, so there are microphones in front of us. And the parties involved in a dispute are called into the room. It's a pretty serious, significant event.
And the guest list is pretty significant as well. Sarah, give us an idea. Who's here?
Well, for a start, F1 Supremo Bernie Eccleston is here. How to describe Bernie? Well, he was, it's a good one. He was F1's ringmaster since the 1970s, really. And there's a saying in F1 that if there weren't any problems, he'd create them. So he'd always get to solve them and be in charge of what's happening, if you like. He was a racer. He used to drive motorbikes and then cars. And then he turned to being a team owner in F1. And Bernie made a lot of money out of the sport. In 2007, he's at the hearing as the sports commercial rights holder. Then, of course, McLaren boss Ron Dennis is here with a selection of his most senior employees. His Ferrari counterpart, Jean Todt, is here too, the diminutive Frenchman affectionately known as Little Napoleon. He started out in motorsport as a rallying co-driver and competed in the World Championship. He actually won the team crown in 1981. His partner is acclaimed actress Michelle Yeoh, who knows the odd bit about spying after starring in a James Bond movie. Todd is an interesting contrast to Ron Dennis. He's a man of few words, he stays away from the limelight, and he prefers to let his team shine. Then there's the entire World Council. They've summoned delegates from across the globe, from countries as far afield as Tanzania and the Dominican Republic.
And presiding over all these personalities is the president of the FIA, Max Mosley, a motorsport titan with over 40 years in the business and a trained barrister to boot. Ferrari's legal counsel, Duncan Aldred, was in Paris that day.
The council members seemed almost fairly largely like wallpaper, really. It was Max Mosley's thing. It really struck me that this was his big show. And it was like him being a Court of Appeal judge in England, and he was going to show everybody how this was done. And he was going to show everybody that they knew how to do this in a business-like way. So there was his personality there, and he was not going to be beaten by anybody. He was top dog.
Top dog is right. Max Mosley came from a very privileged background, but it came with very heavy baggage. Max was born in 1940 during the Second World War to an aristocratic family with strong far-right political views. His father, the fascist leader Oswald Mosley, and his mother Diana, one of the mesmerizing Mitford sisters, were married in 1936 at the home of Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister for Nazi Germany. Adolf Hitler was a guest of honor, and if you're wondering, his wedding gift to the couple was a silver frame picture of himself. Within a few months of Mosley's birth, both his parents were jailed in London's Holloway Prison until he was three. As an adult, he studied at Oxford and dallied with politics, but other than a short stint in the Conservative Party, felt that his background would continually come back to taint his reputation, so he changed tact, first training as a barrister and then going into motorsport. Here, Mosley found a new arena for his talents. And in 1993, he was voted in as president of the FIA. He saw his real work here as improving safety for the drivers, a mission he accelerated after the deaths of Roland Ratzenberger and Ayrton Senna in 1994, and which was extended into safety in the wider car industry. But part of being pres of the FIA was also dealing with disputes.
Max was, I think, in my opinion, one of the finest sports administrators of his generation. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of Formula One and the motorsport world. He knew a lot of these people from many, many years. Had the skills of a lawyer, a barrister, although he had a scientific background before he went to the bar. He loved engineering. He loved to get involved in technical matters. So when he got a case like this, it was just what he liked to do.
The journalist Morris Hamilton met Mosley many times.
He had a fantastic sense of humour, really dry sense of humour, very engaging to talk to. I enjoyed his company enormously, but I was, when doing interviews with him, I was, very wary. You weren't going to win. You know, you just weren't going to win. It's as simple as that. Probably one of the most interesting people I've ever met, actually. Fascinating guy.
He was very fair, very polite, quite a kind of gentleman, aristocrat, as it were. But Max was the iron fist in the velvet glove. You didn't cross him lightly, and he was very persistent.
An extraordinary leader for this extraordinary meeting. Sarah, what do we know about the case at this point?
Okay, so by now it's accepted that Mike Coughlin, McLaren's chief designer, obtained a stash of Ferrari technical data from his old friend Nigel Stepney, a long-term Ferrari employee, although neither man is present at the hearing. At this stage, Nigel Stepney has been sacked by Ferrari and Mike Coughlan has been suspended by McLaren.
I was actually surprised they weren't there, but okay, so they're out of the picture.
Yes. Now, as we've already heard, Ferrari aren't going to get the opportunity to say anything in the hearing, but 10 days before this Paris meeting, Ferrari has issued a strongly worded memorandum to the council with 118 pages of supporting documents. This was never made public, but we hear from Max Mosley in a classic bit of British understatement that the tone was somewhat outraged. In short, it alleges that the stolen data was seen not just by Coughlan, but by four senior McLaren employees, including their CEO and managing director.
Wait, so how does Ferrari know this?
Well, at this stage, we can only assume it's come from those juicy Coughlan affidavits. Remember, only Ferrari would have been privy to this information.
Okay, Sarah, so how seriously are the council members taking the data breach?
Well, it was a big deal for them.
From what we could see in terms of the information, it was incredibly valuable and incredibly important. I mean, if you think about the consequences of one team knowing everything about perhaps their main competitor car, one can understand the significance of it. It's also important to remember that we're also thinking not only about the 2007 car and its operations, because the dossier explained that, but also this was a critical time when you were designing the 2008 car as well. So there was information in that dossier that would have been vital to have a look at if you wanted to know what your competitors were doing while you're designing a 2008 car.
In response to Ferrari's accusations, McLaren gives an emphatic denial. Right, Sarah, it's time to play lawyer. We've got the entire transcript of the hearing, as you can hear. It's a monster, but let's break it down. Let's start with Ron.
Well, Ron Dennis starts telling the council how his company has been, quote, dragged through filth, through spin and innuendo. Then he moves on to express how he's fighting for his, quote, own personal integrity and the integrity of his company. You get the idea. This leads us nicely to the very first thing that McLaren starts their defence with, and this is the thing that really gets Max Mosley's goat.
Okay, go on.
As well as insisting they've not seen the Ferrari data, they're also saying, hey, we're actually helping out here.
Come again?
So do you remember in episode 2, we talked about Ferrari's flexing floor, the one they win the first race of the season in Australia with, a feature on the car that's subsequently banned by the FIA?
Yep.
Well, as you may remember, Nigel Stepney was the one who told Mike Coughlan about the floor. And the reason the floor gets banned by the FIA is because Coughlan mentions it to his bosses at McLaren, including Ron Dennis himself. They then ask the FIA if they can run a similar design, a sneaky way to get Ferrari's floor banned without openly dobbing Ferrari in.
Wait, hang on. So they're saying at this early stage that Nigel was leaking information as some kind of whistleblower?
Yes. McLaren say Stepney was, quote, bringing forward bona fide concerns that his employer was breaching the rules of the sport. But here's what Graham Stoker made of this.
So the whistleblowing argument was a way of explaining the fact they appeared to have got confidential information on the design of the floor of the Ferrari. I don't think any of the World Council members were too impressed with it.
Okay, so let's imagine that the whole floor incident was well-intentioned. But surely they're not going to try and pass off the whole 780-page dossier as a whistleblowing exercise?
No, of course not. As McLaren sees it, these are two completely separate events. The whistleblowing on one hand and the dossier on the other. The dossier was all about the two rogue employees, Coughlan and Stepney, conspiring to get better jobs at Honda or maybe another F1 team. Or, as Ron Dennis tells the room, to go, quote, where the money lies. So it's all about personal gain and nothing to do with anyone else at McLaren.
In their absence, McLaren are going hard on the personal ambitions of these men then?
Yes, and notably they're saying Nigel Stepney, not their employee, is the instigator. He's described by Ron as, quote, not a particularly stable individual, whatever the case.
Ouch.
Yeah, and as for their own employee, we get rather a lot of detail on Coughlin's emotional state. When Jonathan Neal, the managing director at McLaren, is questioned, he has a lot to say. Firstly, Jonathan Neal says Mike Coughlin is, quote, a creative individual in spirit and can be an emotional individual. Then he says that Mike Coughlin has been displaying, quote, increasingly erratic behaviour, and that Jonathan Neal has on many occasions settled him. In fact, Jonathan Neal basically says that settling Mike Coughlin down is one of his key jobs at McLaren.
So basically they're saying that he's a high-maintenance employee.
Yes. Here are some choice quotes for you. Okay. So, first of all, he's unhappy at work, feeling and, quote, an erosion of his authority and is, quote, becoming increasingly emotional and acerbic.
Things are not looking good for Coughlin.
No, and to top it all off, they seem to be seriously downplaying his role doing any actual design work in the company. Ron uses the term orchestrator rather than designer when talking about him, and then says that Mike Coughlin is merely, quote, a sign-off point for the thousands of different technical drawings that come his way. And to quote Ron here, this is not the design process and his role was not in the creation of the racing car.
So they're trying to say he's not very important. They're trying to say that the chief designer has nothing to do with any actual designing.
Yep.
How's this all going down with President Max Mosley?
Well, there's a classic exchange between the two when Max responds to all this by declaring, and here's another juicy quote from the hearing, "You are thus saying he made no contribution." And then there's a swift backtrack from Ron Dennis, who says, and here's another quote, "There's not a single employee at McLaren who does not contribute to our winning races."
Mosley 1, Dennis 0. And it's the first of many for the iron fist in the velvet glove. In a way, it's fitting that neither of our so-called spies, and I'm doing those inverted commas in the air, are in the room, because the real tag team of the moment are Ron and Max.
Yes, Pete, they're addressing each other on first name terms now, almost in the style of an old married couple. Graham says there were times when it felt like they were having a personal battle of wills, and Ferrari's legal counsel, Duncan Aldred, had a front row seat, and he remembers Ron Dennis trying desperately to make his mark.
He seemed very keen to compete with Max Mosley in some way, and not to sort of bend the knee to Max Mosley, or let Max Mosley know that he, Ron, thought that Max was better equipped for this kind of event. But unfortunately, Ron, I got the impression that his vocabulary didn't really stretch to that. And Max Mosley could outthink Ron Dennis very easily.
They sound like a combustible relationship on any day of the week.
Exactly, and this wasn't a new thing. Maurice Hamilton remembers the contrast between the two of them.
Ron Dennis and Max Mosley were like chalk and cheese in that Mosley was what you might call old school, and Ron Dennis was new money, if you like. And he was everything that Max Mosley probably didn't want to be, because Mosley was quite patrician in his ways. Yeah, I think he found Ron amusing in a sort of quite nasty way, actually. And Ron didn't know what to make of Max. I think that was probably part of it as well, because Mosley was very, very eloquent indeed, being a barrister formerly. And Ron was guilty of what we call Ron speak, where he would use big words sometimes and he would stumble over his words trying to say the right thing. So, you know, you had this disparity there.
And these guys have history, right?
Oh, yes, they go way back. They both started out in F1 at the same time back in the 1960s. And remember, at that time, they were barely out of their teens, so they've really grown up in F1 and they would have seen each other around for many, many years. So there's a lot of history even there. But this is not the first time that they've locked horns. The most famous clash between Ron Dennis and Max Mosley was in 1995. Dennis was opposed to now FIA president Max Mosley's plan to effectively sell F1's commercial rights to Bernie Eccleston and launch legal action along with a few other teams. Dennis felt Mosley was selling the family silver and giving away too much power, not to mention money.
Battle of the egos.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in the hearing, Ron is getting increasingly frustrated. Meanwhile, his old adversary is keeping his cool.
I thought Max, I was very conscious of the fact that he was conducting himself extremely carefully to be 100% polite to Ron Dennis. I got the impression that Max Mosley was very, very conscious of the fact there was a transcript running and that he wanted every word to read perfectly so that nobody could pick it apart afterwards and make any complaints about this process that he'd had.
He's not wrong. If you've got time, Google it. It reads like a soap opera. Okay, back to the hearing. There are a couple of meetings that we need to talk about, right?
Yes, okay. So the first one happens on the 28th of April in Barcelona between Mike Coughlan and Nigel Stepney. Remember our eyewitness account from the marina from last time?
I went down to the marina and on the Saturday morning walked around the corner and there sitting in a restaurant was Mike Coughlan and Nigel Stepney.
This is most likely where the data exchanged hands.
Okay, tell me more.
Now, McLaren say in the hearing that after the whole car floor incident thing, they told Coughlan that he was to have no more contact with Nigel Stepney. But Stepney keeps it coming. So McLaren puts up a firewall on Coughlan's computer to stop these messages arriving. Apparently, this isn't enough for Stepney to get the hint. So according to McLaren, the next stage of the plan is to send Coughlan to meet Stepney in person and cut him off. They think the upcoming test in Barcelona, where most of the teams will be to test the latest tech bits and bobs for the cars, is a convenient place to do it. So this part of the plan is given the green light by managing director Jonathan Neal.
Sorry, what? He's told to fly to Barcelona to meet Nigel to stop communications.
Yeah, I mean, as Max Mosley puts in, here's a quote, "Going to Barcelona is much more consistent with going to pick up 700 pages of documents than to cease in communication." But that's the story coming from McLaren. And whilst they accept that this is when Coughlan took the Ferrari dossier, they're saying this was for his personal benefit and nothing to do with them.
OK, so that's our first meeting out of the way. And then a month later, on the 25th of May, another meeting. This time in the UK between Coughlan and his boss, Jonathan Neal. This time it's luncheon at a country club. Sounds rather cosy.
Oh, yes, but this is the meeting where Ferrari alleged that Jonathan Neal actually sees some of their data.
So how are McLaren explaining this one then?
Well, as you know, McLaren have been telling us how unsettled their employee Mike Coughlan has been. He's erratic, increasingly dissatisfied at work, and it's Jonathan Neal's job to settle him down. So we are told this meeting has the purpose of settling Mike in a, quote, relaxed environment, hence the luncheon at a country club. We hear that 90 minutes into the meeting, suddenly Coughlan says he wants to tell Neal something in strict confidence. And then he puts a bag on the table and tries to pull pieces of paper out of it.
Are these going to be some Ferrari documents?
Well, I'm going to quote to you, Pete, exactly what Jonathan Neal said, as this sequence of events is a bit confusing. So first of all, he says, quote, "It was not possible for me to know or determine what he had as he was seated at the table across from me." But then he does say, quote, "He was able to focus a bit on one of those pieces of paper." But at this stage, he stops Coughlan from showing him anything by putting his hands up and then saying, quote, "Mike, at this stage, wherever this conversation is going, I do not think it is material. And if, as I suspect, you are about to tell me something that I wouldn't want to know, then I ask you not to do so and to destroy anything that you have."
Wait, hang on. So he's not seen what's on these pieces of paper, although he's managed to half focus on one of them, and yet he wants Coughlan to destroy them.
Yes, that's right.
So what does Jonathan Neal actually say he thinks Mike Coughlan is trying to show him?
Yeah, so Jonathan Neal tells the hearing his deduction was Coughlan was about to divulge a potential job offer from another organisation.
It's definitely not something else like, say, some secret Ferrari documents.
No, he says, and here's another quote, "I honestly believed it to be an insignificant issue, and at no point did he give me any reason to believe that it was either Ferrari material or part of a greater bundle or dossier."
So let me get this story straight. Coughlan pulls out some documents. Neil catches a glimpse but doesn't know what he's seen, and yet then insists it was, quote, insignificant.
Yes. Now, Jonathan Neil got a bit of a grilling about what he had or hadn't seen. Max Mosley accuses Neil of wanting to, quote, turn a blind eye. Bernie Eccleston also chimes in. I was curious what the council made of that particular bit of evidence.
I mean, the idea that there was a bag on the table, I'm assuming with a 780-page dossier in it, so it must have been quite a kind of large bag, but no one was interested in looking at it. And one put one's hand up. I don't know. There we are. That's what we were told.
Just before all the parties present are asked to leave so they can deliberate the verdict, Dennis has a parting plea. Please use your hearts as well as your heads. There's a bit of a joke in F1 that FIA stands for Ferrari International Assistance. There's a sense that Ferrari are the favourite pupils, if you like, because sometimes Ferrari do things like threaten to leave the sport, and F1 just wouldn't be F1 without Ferrari, as we've already heard. And if Ferrari do something naughty on the track, then they often get away with it more than the other teams. They've been known to come down on Ferrari's side a few times. On this occasion, however,
we felt at the end of the day that we had to give them the benefit of the doubt, and it appeared that it was just one rogue employee and it hadn't really spread throughout the McLaren team itself.
McLaren is found to be in breach of Article 151C of the Sporting Code, but the evidence that they've used the Ferrari information to their advantage is insufficient for any penalty to be imposed.
So effectively, McLaren are off the hook.
Exactly, but Ron Dennis can't let it go just yet. Right after the verdict is announced by Max Mosley, he makes an appeal to the FIA. He'd like them to leave the word guilty out of their imminent press release. Of course, he understands there may be a desire to do so, but you see, it's not going to do any good to McLaren's already damaged reputation when the story hits the press. And he wants to get on with fighting for the championship. It's important for F1, he says.
Mosley does have the final word, though. He congratulates McLaren's lawyer, Ian Mill, for doing an outstanding job keeping his excellent client, in other words, Ron, quote, under control. And then he goes off for a cup of tea with Ron in tow. Meanwhile, in Camp Ferrari, the news has gone down like a punctured tyre. They can't understand why it matters whether McLaren used their information for gain or not.
Well, there was this big question around, which was, if an athlete takes drugs, then the athlete has to suffer a penalty for that. And you don't look at, has the athlete produced better times as a result and so on. So there was a dreadful feeling of injustice about the whole thing.
So a shocked and angered Luca Colliani has to somehow put together a press release with the team's feelings.
As you can imagine, it's a little bit difficult to accept a decision like that. And it was difficult to accept because you cannot understand, especially in a sport where the knowledge is so important. So we issued a very strong press release, I remember. But then we had to face that apparently nothing was going to happen.
Apparently being the operative word. After the theatre of the day's proceedings, there's a resounding feeling that the matter is unresolved. And Max Mosley makes it crystal clear they'll be ready to reconvene should any new evidence emerge, where McLaren would be faced with the possibility of exclusion, not only from this year's season, but 2008 as well. In the background, one of the most dramatic and intense seasons in F1's history is thundering on. After a narrow escape in Paris, McLaren is edging its rival on the track too. Just a couple of days before the hearing, Fernando Alonso has taken his third victory of the year in neighboring Germany. But all is not well on Fernando's side of the garage. Mechanic Mark Priestley is down in the garage ahead of the race when he's handed a little brown envelope.
It wasn't Fernando that gave it to me personally. It came through his trainer or his manager, I think, had been handing them out. Lo and behold, when we opened them, had a bundle of cash inside. And I remember being absolutely flabbergasted when I opened it. And I was amazed. I was, you know, the question, of course, is what's this for? And then internally, the only conclusion that we could all come to was, well, you know, did you get one? Yeah, I got one. Did you get one? No. Yeah, I got one. What about you guys over on Lewis's car? No, we didn't get one. Okay, right, starting to build a picture here. So you start to jump to your own conclusions that this might be trying to almost buy support so that the power of his fight in this championship had a little bit more behind it than perhaps this young kid on the other side of the garage did.
Is Alonso's insecurity about his place on the team starting to show? Either way, that's nothing compared to what's about to go down the following week at the Hungarian Grand Prix. That's next time on Spygate.
Hungary was the moment from which there was absolutely no going back.
We start waving him and everyone start looking at each other thinking, what on earth is he up to here? Is the car broken? Has the radio stopped working? And it dawns on us that this is for real. This is orchestrated. He's doing this on purpose.
It was also, right, screw you. You're going to do that to me. I'm going to get you back.
I thought, you're guilty. You're just guilty. You can't look at anybody in the eye.
Spygate is a Chalk and Blade production for the BBC. The producers are Matt Nielsen and Rosie Stopher. Sound design is by Alex Paul Felix, and the showrunner is Sarah Stollard.
F1. We'll get into the rights and the wrongs and the who's and the whatnots later on in the Checker Flag podcast. We'll bring you all the reaction as well to what has been a very entertaining Grand Prix.
Get analysis and reaction after each Grand Prix from the expert Five Live Formula One team with the Checkered Flag podcast.
What a race that was!
Listen on BBC Sounds.